libertarians have often been divided on intellectual property, or kind of unclear. Is intellectual property something that is like owning regular property or real property that, you know, it's a piece of land that you can take and subdivide and sell to whoever you want and certain rights inhere in that? Or is it actually a short-term or a limited-term government-granted monopoly on a stream of revenue or ownership rights that go to something that you make, whether it's a patent or a copyright? The Progress Clause of the United States Constitution grants Congress the authority to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. This was a big deal during the Constitutional Convention. I guess, Brink, why don't you start? Is that the beginning and end of the argument for intellectual property, patent, and copyright, just that the government grants it for a limited period of time, and that's all we should be talking about?
Well, I don't think for libertarians. The genius of the term intellectual property should not be underestimated. It's like the best savvying marketing ploy since, predates the death tax. But when you have a term like that just stacks the debate in your favor, then good for whoever comes up with that. And so the term intellectual property immediately puts free market-oriented conservatives and libertarians disposed towards, well, I like property rights, so I must like this. But just because you can create tradable property rights in something doesn't necessarily mean it's a good idea to do that. You have tradable property rights in taxi medallions. We don't think that's a good idea.
We don't mistake it for something that, a Lockean property that, you know, the taxi cab driver found in nature and then added his sweat and now owns a taxi.
Right. And of course, once upon a time, we had property rights in human beings and they were defended zealously as part of the sacred institution of property. And we don't think that's a good idea. But in the case of intellectual property, the idea is to take this Lockean notion of how unowned physical property becomes owned by mixing your labor with it and applying that to the realm of ideas. The problem is that's just, I think, a massive category error because the Lockean notion is about how to create rights in previously unowned property. Nobody thinks that just mixing your labor with stuff you don't own and somebody else owns turns it into your stuff. So auto workers take steel and glass and rubber and turn it into cars, they mix their labor with it, doesn't make it theirs, right? The stuff was owned by the auto company and the car is owned by the auto company. So the mere fact that you come up with an idea doesn't then create property rights in previously owned physical property, which is what actually is happening, that you are basically creating control rights over property. You can't use your property to copy my invention or my book or my record. And so that is, I think, just a real inversion of the Lockean notion of natural rights and property.
Eli, do you want to speak to the question? Now, there is no question that copyright and patent has led to some forms of progress, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I come at this as a libertarian, not a natural rights libertarian, not as an axiomatic libertarian. So there are people who come from that tradition who have argued on both sides of intellectual property, right? Who have axiomatically reasoned that intellectual property rights are completely invalid and that they should be permanent and last forever. And so that's not how I come at it. I come at it as much more just like an average guy on the street with a couple different intellectual filters.
Just an average guy on the street. Yeah. How many degrees do you have?
A couple intellectual filters, right? So one thing that I think libertarians know that other people don't is public choice, right? That when government starts handing out goodies, like people are going to start manipulating the political environment in order to get more of them. And the other thing I think libertarians know that maybe the average guy on the street doesn't know is spontaneous order, right? That no top-down control over innovation sometimes works. So both of those filters push the optimal amount of IP in the direction of less IP. But it doesn't mean that you should completely abolish it necessarily. It just means less than probably what we
well,
have
here,
and
can,
where we end up.
Can somebody on the panel remind us of what was the term? What was the copyright term when the Constitution was written, and what is it now?
It was 14 years originally.
Right, and it could be renewed
once.
Yeah, renewable once.
Right, and now it is.
Now it's life of the author plus 70 years.
Or for a corporate copyright, it's 100 years or something. Yeah. So, and Sasha, is that part of the problem that these terms have gone from, you know, being limited, which the Constitution talks about, to effectively being unlimited? Because as Eli was talking about, you know, every time Mickey Mouse, every time a couple of different major properties come up for being fed into the public domain, something happens and the copyright term gets extended yet again.
Oh, for sure. I mean, there always has to be a starting point. And we have to give, say, Cookie for innovation and knowing that you did a good job and therefore you should get some protection. But continually extending it, we inhibit ingenuity, we inhibit progress, we inhibit what the Constitution essentially asks of the population to continue to create, to continue to better yourself, and to continue the progress of innovation, literature, maps if you want to get down there, the general sciences. Mm-hmm. And it's incredibly problematic.
Can anybody talk a little, like specifically, what is the damage? I mean, there's a question, and we should get to this, of whether or not, is it true that progress, you know, needs copyright? Or would people write, would people invent, would people innovate without it?
I could talk to that a little bit. I mean, okay. And I think the evidence is, I think most inventions are not under patent. I mean, most inventions occurred on their own. So whether that's a spur to innovation or not, is a legitimate question. You have people doing these things on their own. And some of the, like Heidi Miller, she just won a MacArthur Award. She's done a lot of interesting work looking at the human genome and when you're patenting that. And she actually found that the patent inhibited innovation because there were fewer, I think 35% fewer follow-ons to Celera, which is the one she's looked at. Mm-hmm. So I think there's plenty of evidence
now,
out there.
And that's embedded in that is also because maybe copyright and patent are very different, right? Because they're dealing with different types of innovations or different types of technologies. But Eli, you look like you wanted to jump
in. So when I think about this question, I always think of Wikipedia, right? This is something that doesn't work at all in theory, but it works in practice. So you have no protection for contributions that people make, really significant contributions of putting in a lot of time, writing, researching, and so on. And it's the biggest encyclopedia that the world has ever seen.
It's the online encyclopedia that anyone can edit.
Anybody can edit. It's pretty good evidence that we would get that sort of
And certainly people talk a lot about in the fields of fashion and cuisine, there are no intellectual property rights and there is massive amounts of innovation.
Correct.
And it's all based on kind of what you were talking about of using and ripping off, copying, knocking off, changing.
And meanwhile, the overwhelming majority of copyrighted books and records, copyright is completely irrelevant to them. So 98% of all records or whatever, CDs, whatever released now, sell under 5,000 copies, which means nobody's copying them.
I thought you weren't going to bring up the sales figures of the Declaration of Independence, the book that Matt Welch and I wrote, but thank you.
There aren't good stats on kind of median book sales, but for business books, I found stats. Only 62 out of 1,000 business books sell more than 5,000
but
copies.
But here, so just very quickly, and then 6%. We'll come to Sasha, but you know, is a publisher, is Macmillan, is Simon & Schuster, are they going to publish books the way that they publish without copyright protection?
So again, if 98-99% of all published material nobody ever copies because the demand for it is so small, then yes, the vast majority of now copyrighted works would, I think, continue to have the same market. You wouldn't have the mass market recording artists, you might not have the CGI blockbusters, although these days they're so stacked towards the opening weekend that there is more scope for getting in there and getting your money before somebody copies you. So,
which interestingly goes back to 19th century publishing roots where American authors would publish first in England and get money there and then bring it back to the US.
And I just want to clarify, I'm not an abolitionist, but I think this this aura of sacred property rights needs to be deconstructed so we can talk about this just in terms of consequences, good or ill.
I mean, we have a problem. We're not talking about copyright per se, but we need to realize, I don't think it's been talked about, is unpublished works. Mm-hmm. You don't need a notice. You don't need to register. Registration is only if you decide to litigate. If you don't, you can have your book be in the public, but you could also...
It used to be that way.
Right. It did not used to be until 76,
right.
But that was because we had to coincide with international law, and the United States had to kind of come to the same elevated point as everybody else. So I don't necessarily think the copyright conversation specifically be on copyright and the text itself, but the idea of published and unpublished works. Mm.
Can you?
Right now, there are gigantic troves of information that can be digitized and shared and accessed, but people can't do it because they don't know who owns the copyright, and so it just.
I was going to ask, what are some of the specific harms that we can say are being inflicted by current copyright? And that's certainly one of them. All of these movies, recordings, books, where it's not clear who owns the copyright, so nobody is going to go in and just republish them.
Right. And then we're stuck with orphan works.
Right.
And back in June, the Copyright Office released a statement how we could possibly handle orphan works, and no one's brought it up. And the issue with them is there have been suggestions that we kind of have a government-owned registrar. List of orphan works, you can go and you can claim it and you get 35 years. Don't quote me on that exactly. But that's a big issue we have right now. And with the extension of copyright, what do you do with these works just floating around into the ether?
Right, and there are cases where many of you may be familiar with the movie It's a Wonderful Life. How many of you have seen that? How many of you think that was a Christmas classic from the time that it was released? Yeah, it actually wasn't. It went into the public domain in the late 60s, early 70s, and because it was free, a bunch of local TV stations picked it up and started running it because they could. And that's when it was a bomb when it came out originally. And so that's an example of where having works in the public domain or not under copyright actually, we were able to get real value out of that.
I think another specific harm is that people are now using copyright law to do things completely unrelated to protecting works, such as protecting firmware on cell phones, protecting firmware on garage door openers and so on, to prevent sort of compatibility just on using your devices. So it's a recent story
that you can't work on your own car or truck, or you can't take it to an independent garage because the software is owned by GM and you can't.
Yeah, talk a little bit about this. And this is where it also slides over into patent, where patent terms have not been extended to the same extent that copyright terms, but they've been applied to more and more types of activities. What are the problems with that?
So patents, they provide an innovation benefit. They raise the returns for certain kinds of innovations, but they also impose a cost on downstream innovators because almost all innovations are based on the recombination of pre-existing ideas, and if your access to those pre-existing ideas is more expensive because of patents, then the downstream innovation is inhibited. And over the past quarter century, the costs of patent law have been skyrocketing, primarily by the expansion of patent protection into very vaguely defined areas like business methods and software. So with chemicals and with pharmaceuticals, the boundaries of the property right are clearly delineated by a chemical formula. So everybody knows what's infringing and what isn't. The boundaries for a software patent are described in this very abstract language. There's jillions of them, so it would take basically several lifetimes to just go through and read all the patent literature to know whether you're infringing, and then you still wouldn't know because it's very vague abstract.
So does
language.
That actually freeze people out, or are they like, oh, fuck it, let's just do it and we'll see what happens?
Yeah, in Silicon Valley, there's a lot of companies who forbid their engineers from researching whether a particular innovation is patented already because willful infringement actually... You have to pay treble damages.
And that is part of the whole purpose of a patent is that you...
It's disclosing, yes.
Because then everybody can learn from it. That's part of progress.
That's part of why we want it, yeah.
And there's definitely venture capital money that says, I will not touch anything that has an IP risk associated with it. So it does have a chilling effect.
Let's talk a little bit about this in an international context. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, the 12 countries that are dealing with that have, they said, okay, we've got the deal, now we're going to go back to our respective countries. A big part of that, particularly among libertarians in the U.S., is like, we want to see what the IP stuff is in that. How is it good? Is it bad? how does IP play in an international context as opposed to a purely domestic regime?
So the case for extending it to less developed countries is even weaker than the case for the status quo here, because at least here we have a sizable community of copyright and patent holders that have some benefit from it, whereas in a less developed country, it's just by imposing U.S.-style law where they don't have a lot of IP rights holders, then basically what you are negotiating is just a straight-up wealth transfer from those countries right. to the United States. And under the theory that over the long term, if you have IP law, then that will encourage innovation. And a generation or two from now, you'll have lots of patent holders and copyright holders, and you'll benefit too. But for the foreseeable future, it's just a straight-up loss for the countries concerned.
And it's essentially raising the cost of their doing business out of it.
And since I think that the IP status quo is actually bad for innovation, right. then it's actually retarding the day that these countries will converge with us yeah. technologically.
So the U.S. has some of the strongest IP law in the world, and so we're making other countries, for instance, retroactively extend their copyright yeah. terms. And to me, like retroactive extension is the most corrupt thing we could do to copyright ever, and we're making other countries do that in order to be, you know, get access to our market.
Is piracy? I mean, this is what you always hear, whether it's from the recording industry or from various types of patent and copyright holders. You know, is international copyright and patent piracy, is that actually a problem, or is that just kind of big corporate hype in the United States? Sasha?
I guess in the European Union, no, it's not an issue. They've got stricter laws than we do. They respect, or not necessarily respect, but obviously they have different rights schemes than we have. They have something called moral rights. I mean, over there, no. China, Southeast Asia, and so on and so forth. It is somewhat of an issue, but it's also a different context of how they interpret intellectual property. You have a country like India, heavily influenced by Great Britain. So they're going to be kind of in line to the United States, similar schemes. But even then, they have new colleges set up that teaches specifically patents, how to patent, how to invent, what do you do with it. So I think to get to your answer your question, I think piracy is an issue, but I think, yes, it's blown out of proportion into the clouds.
And that's, I think, when you look at piracy and basically it just goes back to, you know, IP in general. We talk about it, you know, as you say, we enshrine it as intellectual property. But in the Constitution, it's basically a statutory grant to Congress mm-hmm. to create a regulatory regime. And today we are living under it, and like any other regulation, I think it has to be evaluated in terms of costs and benefits. And when you look at what they're doing in terms of protecting, stopping online piracy, some of the things like SOPA, PIPA, mm-hmm. parts of the DMCA are so horrendous and so overreaching that if you put it in a cost benefit analysis, I think the costs far outweigh any of the benefits you get from that.
When I think about piracy, I always think about how different industries are responding to the internet, right? Because the internet mm-hmm. is what's enabling all this piracy. And so I think about three different industries. I think about journalism, music, and video, right? And in journalism, I think they've actually gotten the balance kind of right. They, something like the New York Times has a paywall, but it's very porous. It's very easy to get through. And they sort of just accept some level of piracy as a way of doing business and getting the word out about their articles. Maybe someone will like get through the paywall, but then they'll tweet about the article. And that's good for them. So they don't worry about it so much. And I think that they're like the most advanced in terms of how they deal with it. And music is lagging, and then film is like way behind.
Although, and I think Brink was talking a little bit about this. I mean, the way that big movie industries, release video, release films now, they do worldwide same weekend releases, because then there's no need to mm-hmm. pirate, or you minimize that. I mean, Kim.com, the kind of renegade, Anzac, Freakazoid, wonderful. He's got the ultimate Twitter feed. But he talked about how, like, you know, if the movie studios just started doing that, there would be no reason really to pirate mm-hmm. in many ways. So, let's wrap it up, and then we'll throw it out to the audience. Questions about intellectual property always hinge on technology. I mean, when it becomes easy enough to copy something or to spread it around, it happens. And then some, you know, the law will try to stop it. And then it will, you know, the business will come up with a model that makes sense of it. You know, so Napster, people get put in jail, and then you have Spotify or Pandora, you know, 10 or 20 years later. Are we living through a period, and just give a quick answer and then we'll throw it out. You know, are we living through an era where technology is actually disassembling IP? And is that enough, or do we need an intellectual direction in this?
So I think copyright is sustainable in an internet world insofar as it's focused on stopping commercial exploitation of copyrighted content. So you can shut down movie theaters that are showing pirated versions of your film. You can shut down record companies that are making bootleg copies. You can do that. But this Ahabian quest to shut down private, non-commercial copying and sharing, I think, is completely hopeless. And this interpretation by the copyright holders that they own this property and that anybody doing anything that they don't authorize is theft just puts them in this terrible position of considering their customers their enemies, right. and leads them to...
And it works so well for Metallica, right? They're the biggest band in the world now.
So I think that it just breeds a really unhealthy mindset on the part of the industry that they are in this oppositional attitude towards not only their customers but towards all new technology. So they you know, the copyright interests fought the VCR, lost in the Supreme Court just by one vote. It was 5-4
We still are paying.
They fought YouTube.
We're still paying Napster, taxes on blank recording media.
Right, but now it's as easy as ever
right.
to do it privately in these interim kind of lawsuits against random private individuals. They're just awful and they accomplish nothing.
Wayne?
I would say the technology has played an interesting role in how we look at patents and copyright. And different industries have different technologies. And one of the fundamental problems we have when we wrestle with this every year, you know, it comes up in the Congress, they have this big fight, and usually nothing gets resolved, and it goes away. And a few years, they try it again. But I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all system anymore. There should be different approaches for different industries where these things are of different value. And I think you have to sort of get much more granular in the way you look at these things.
So what's an example of an industry that should have stricter IP and one that should have weaker?
Well, I think like machinery in general, like the stuff with Ford and the what's happening with copyrighting the chips inside the cars, versus say a music industry protecting what's on a CD, those kinds of things. And then if you get into the chemical world, like you said, the number of patents revolving around a chemical is basically the chemicals and the formula. So it's a pretty small set of issues that you have to deal with, and trying to cram that into the same issue as Samsung versus Apple with hundreds of thousands of patents, I just don't think it works.
Your question about will the internet make all this go away, for patents, for sure not, because the internet is being fed by the software explosion, and the patent explosion is being fed by software patents.
But for copyright, maybe it's going in a different direction.
And now we've gotten to the point where big companies are buying just huge patent portfolios just to defend themselves. The majority, 60-70% of patent infringement cases are brought by trolls. So they are brought by companies that didn't invent anything against companies that innovate.
I think it's going to be really interesting once 3D printers get better and 3D chemical printers, because then you're talking about things that used to be patentable are just going to be bits of ones and zeros that are going to go around the world just as easily as an MP3 does. And enforcement costs are going to get really high. And enforcement costs are costs, and we should, if we're thinking about it economically, we should consider those costs, and probably we should do less enforcement at some point if that continues.
So do you think that'll be will the people who create new things that are going to be pirated, for lack of a better term, by 3D printing, how will they recoup their expenses? So, a band that could no longer sell records because people don't buy records anymore, they go on tour more. Do you have a sense of what chemical companies might, pharmaceutical companies might
do? I think there are different models. I think fame is a motivator. I think patronage, a lot of my work as as a nonprofit person, I do work and I give it away for free. Right. But I have a patron
at the Mercator
Center.
It's worth every penny.
It's worth every penny, not a penny more, maybe. But I have a patron at the Mercator Center. The Mercator Center is my patron. And
I suspect, too, that it might be a service model because, you know, if you're 3D printing an organ and you're using, like, a hand-me-down file and your liver is kind of bleeding out of your side, you might want to be able to get
maybe
on custom
design. Custom design services or something like
that. Okay. And Sasha?
Kind of a tough question, but I'm going to look at it from a 6,000 feet point of view. As technology evolves, the public consciousness evolves. So I think it's very short-sighted of us to start throwing our hands up in the air and panicking and saying, leave it to the courts, you know, Congress will get behind it, things of that sort. I just don't see why we can't, because as CDs don't sell, Pandora Media suddenly becomes the next popular thing. Now Spotify's in the marketplace. 5 years ago, I didn't know what Spotify was, and I'm the quote-unquote millennial generation. So I think if we give up now and we start really hammering down and we start freaking out at this point in time, we're going to inhibit innovation. And I think it's a big mistake. So I see technology actually aiding the public consciousness, aiding everyone in this room to see what's the next big thing. How can we kind of work around this issue and then go back and improve it, better legislator.